Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents River Songs, Moments of Wild Wonder in Fly Fishing by Steve Duda. Narrated by Steve Duda. For Lori, my confidant, companion, and co-conspirator, siempre mejor. The only people who inveigh against escape are jailers. J.R.R. Tolkien. Lessons. Fly fishing teaches us a few things about a few things. We know which way is north and which direction the winds blow when the weather's about to turn. We can stop the bleeding, patch the leaks, and always have duct tape handy. We know a few good knots, a few good jokes, and can curse in a handful of languages. We can pitch a tent in the dark and point to a few constellations. We know how to ford a river, build a fire, and brew a cup of coffee. We can open a beer with almost anything. We're good sports and gracious winners who are used to long odds and making friends with failure. We're blessed with a vast reservoir of hope, and we trust that better outcomes and brighter prospects, the next cast, the next run, the next day, are around the next bend. We're a family of enthusiastic activists, weirdos, obsessives, and oddballs exploring the peculiar back alleys, sidetracks, and secret rooms of our sport. Fly fishing isn't just one thing. It's a whirling ball of bamboo rods, blue lining, and bass. It's poetry, permit, and plotting to bring down deadbeat dams. It's tarpon, tenkara, and the alchemy of old fishing caps. It's carp, conservation, and keeping a cigar lit in a sideways gully washer. It's steelhead, shore lunches, and the beauty of native fish. It's strange and beautiful, beautifully strange, and it's what we do. Most of all, this is a family that understands and appreciates the enormity, wildness, and wonder of the outdoors. Together, we stand in its light with humility, appreciation, and the determination not to lose what we love. When you try to explain these things, they might sound silly or absurd or a waste of time. But more than anything, we understand that having a compass, knowing which way the wind blows, and finding shelter from a storm count for something. And if a ridiculous activity like fly fishing can help us to be a generous friend, point us toward excellence, and encourage a profound and abiding love for this planet, then spending time sitting on a riverbank, watching clouds pass overhead seems to be an excellent way to spend our days. That lesson, it's as real as it gets. 1. Ghosts. When the buffalo are gone, we will hunt mice. For we are hunters, and we want our freedom. Sitting Bull. Come early summer, Washington State's Columbia Basin is a griddle. Heat wobbles everything. Wind sandblasts paint off abandoned farm equipment, and red-tailed hawks ride upswelling thermals for hours, looking for something, anything to rustle the sage. Despite the inhospitable nothingness, the sweet smell of mint carries on the wind. There are apple stands along the melting two-lane asphalt roads. Trucks loaded with sugar beets regularly rumble past. Since 1948, the Columbia Basin Project has been siphoning what equates to the annual flow of the Colorado River from the once mighty Columbia to slake the thirst of the vineyards, orchards, and hop vines that paint what should be a dusty brown canvas in huge, regularly irrigated green circles and rectangles. Nothing fragile should grow here, but thanks to the metronomic click, click, click of the center pivot and the sputtering snake hiss of the wheel line irrigation systems, it does. We plot trips to this desert only when it's decided it's simply too damn hot to fly fish for trout a few miles away. After all, who wants to jump jolt over the Yakima Canyon's ornery crew of Northern Pacific rattlesnakes and then broil on a casting deck slinging flies to overheated, sluggish red band rainbows when instead we could death march along the scorching Columbia, post hole through knee-high, foul-smelling muck, and pitch to indifferent, skittish carp that may or may not even be there in the first place. The Columbia, of course, once hosted history's most prolific salmon runs. Archaeological evidence tells us the fish have been harvested here for at least 10,000 years, nourishing thriving, sustainable civilizations. Salmon are everywhere and are everything to the native cultures along the Columbia and her tributaries. From creation stories to art to commerce to the regeneration of the land and spirit, this is salmon country. And those of us who live here are, we flatter ourselves, still salmon people. This water's true name is Nichiwana, Great River. When the Lewis and Clark expedition began its drift toward the Pacific in the autumn of 1805, William Clark noted that the rivers were crowded with salmon. Indeed, the number of dead salmon on the shores and floating in the river is incredible to say. Ask any old-timer about the runs before Roosevelt's dam started going up in the 1930s, and you'll hear the old chestnut about being able to promenade across the Nichiwana on the banks of the salmon and never soak your boots. The sad collapse of this once-teeming abundance has been well-documented. Careless environmental practices, overfishing, resource extraction, failed hatchery remediation, and inefficient, pitiless dams conspired to bully salmon populations into free fall. Our present spectral returns are a seasonal reminder of a short-sighted hubris as awe-inspiring as the vast, lonely spaces that this flow once dominated. Nothing symbolizes this tragedy more than the events of April 29, 1955. On that day, the Oregon Historical Society turned up at a small village along the Columbia with a moving camera and a reporter to document the Feast of the First Salmon. For Celilo Falls, the site of a diverse, thriving tribal community and one of North America's oldest continually occupied sites, the feast was usually a day of celebration and ecstatic connection with the earth. On this warm and blustery spring day, however, it was a wake. It would be the final ceremony before the falls, its scaffolded fishing stations, and its small village were submerged by the backwaters of the Dalles Dam. There's a 19-minute film documenting the events. It's easy to find on the internet. The ceremony is captured from a clinical remove. Each ritual, dance, and movement are flatly described, and the camera is left to linger awkwardly on the scene. Intrusive, out of context, banal. Its grainy black and white footage is accompanied by a scratchy soundtrack that makes it seem like it was recorded centuries ago. The voiceover narration is as dry as dead leaves and painfully elides the tragedy playing out on the film. As the herky-jerky recording captures the sad scene, the narrator intones, "Though the Indians live modestly, their hospitality is lavish." By early 1957, the gates of the Dalles Dam were closed in Celilo Falls, the narrowing of the Great River where Umatilla, Klickitat, Walla Walla, Cayuse, Nez Perce, Yakima, Warm Springs, and other tribes had fished, traded, and convened since before time was counted on calendars, was swallowed up forever. "Once this was our land, and Celilo was our falls," remarked Flora Thompson, wife of Wyom Chief Tommy Thompson. "Now our lands and our fishing places are gone, and soon we will be gone too. Once we were many, now we are few." Today, we are left with Cyprinus carpio, the rather glumly designated common carp. The regret accusations, and hand-wringing trotted out when the Columbia's ghost salmon are mentioned are matched only by the contempt for our current quarry. When the subject is raised, carp are usually on the receiving end of eradication programs, crossbows, or quartersticks of dynamite. Among fly anglers, however, there is love enough. The common carp has been recast as the fabled basalt bonefish, the wily and elusive Columbia River brownback, the rod-busting desert ditch pig. Unlike salmon and steelhead, wild creatures requiring an ocean's worth of space to grow, carp took quickly to domestication, which happened more or less simultaneously across the globe. In the 5th century CE, a Chinese businessman named Fan Li wrote instructions for raising them in ponds. Around the same time, well-to-do Romans grew them in specially constructed pools. For the Romans, carp was considered a delicacy fit for feasting, served roasted, boiled, or pickled, and accompanied by oysters, pheasant, peacock, and slabs of bread, all helped down the gullet by cups of watered-down red wine. Carp fishing was mentioned by Sir Isaac Walton in 1653. He writes in The Complete Angler, "The carp is the queen of rivers, a stately, a good, and a very subtle fish that was not at first bred, nor hath been long in England, but is now naturalized." Carp fishing is still a very big and very serious deal in the United Kingdom. There are multiple magazines detailing hundreds of techniques and selling thousands of pieces of gear, all aimed at snagging a big-bellied carp wallowing in a pay-to-play lake fishery. It was an anonymous Oregonian who, in 1880, set himself up with a few dozen carp imported from Germany, a handsome new spawning pond on the banks of the Columbia, and lofty dreams of menus featuring carp caviar, jellied carp, carp soup, and thick carp steaks. These finned pioneers were hardly common. According to the surviving narrative, the vanguard that begat the Columbia River population were, according to the surviving account, genuine German carp and perfect beauties. Within a year, the brood grew to more than 7,000 fish. That spring, however, disaster struck. A never-ending northwest deluge caused the pond to overflow and fail, sending the beauties finning into the Columbia. Finding a happy home in the river, the exceptionally adaptable carp did what they do best. They bred quickly and frequently, and they got big, fast. By the turn of the 20th century, Columbia carp were being harvested in massive numbers and used as fertilizer for farmers. The cost? $5 a ton. A few years ago, for about 20 minutes, fly fishing for carp was the hot new thing in the United States. Perhaps it was because of the hostility heaped upon the fish due to their homely looks and brutish ways that they became the anti-heroes, the punk rock bonefish of the fly fishing world. The hype didn't last. Most fly anglers went back to their trout streams because the truth is, carp can be as tricky to hook as a permit. They ain't all that easy to find, and once hooked, well then what? Every carp expedition begins with recon, but because carp anglers are conspiratorial and secretive, reliable information is always remarkably difficult to come by. Dam release schedules are studied, water temps verified, and a single trusted contact residing near the flats is gently prodded, bribed, for first-hand intel. Mostly, we go by our guts. Does the forecast call for hot, hotter, hot as hell? Will the winds be calm? Will the water be low enough to expose the stalking grounds? Columbia River carp flourish in the wide spots between the hated dams. What was once described by cold, tumbling runs and broad, sweeping pools stuffed with salmon is today a tepid, featureless, barely moving reservoir pinched between the United States Army's Yakima Training Center firing range on one side and row after row of apple trees and prefab housing on the other. To get to the Carp Flats from Seattle, cross the Columbia Advantage and head south. Drive past the cherry stands near Beverly, the taco trucks at Mattawa, and the wineries at the base of the Saddle Mountains until you see the post that formerly held the sign pointing to where the public fishing access used to be. Take a sharp right and skirt the destroyed single track to the river. Shift into 4x4 mode and follow the trace along the bank. Park out of sight, in the shade. Drink some water and enjoy a last moment of air-conditioned comfort in your truck. It's about to get hot. Carp creep onto the river's flats, broad expanses of clear, knee-high water that shelter and nourish vast underwater fields of clams. When the sun is high and the water warm. When you walk across the flats to an exposed island 200 yards offshore, the shells crunch underfoot. The bottom is riddled with pockmarks caused by the rooting snouts of big, hungry fish sucking up the bivalves. It's impossible to miss the areas where carp have been. The river bottom looks like a lunar surface, riddled by a meteorite storm. There are many theories when it comes to fly selection. Woolly buggers, everyday trout nymphs such as pheasant tails and hare's ears, bonefish flies, and crawfish patterns have all been known to work. Most carp anglers prefer self-styled creations, quick-sinking, nymph-shaped inventions with just enough movement, a whiff of rabbit tail, a shock of marabou, to catch the eye of a gorging carp. Anglers wade deliberately across the flats. Everyone looks as if they are in slow motion, and their profiles shimmer in the unrelenting heat as they drift farther and farther apart. Carping is a sight fishing activity, and when one is spotted, the game has just begun. If the carp is a cruiser, swimming with a targeted purposefulness of a deep water submarine, forget it. Let it swim by. Cruisers don't eat, and eaters ain't cruising. Spot one with a nose pressed to the riverbed, tail swishing in the air, and a small puff of mud discoloring the water nearby, and then, well, maybe. Are you close enough? 40-foot casts just don't cut it on the carp flats. You need to see the carp inhale the fly. Creep closer. Peel some line. Measure. Not too many false casts. No line whipping over the target. No sudden movements. No crossing shadows. No overhead birds. No sloppy casts. Place the fly gently. Yes, there. A carp can suck up a fly from a surprising distance, and a strike telegraphs a weighty, dull thump through the line. More than likely, the fly is lodged in the carp's thick, rubbery lip. It's not coming out till your tippet breaks, the rod snaps, or you land the fish. A carp's initial run is like a logging truck chugging down a steep grade. At first, it's not rolling that quickly, but good luck getting it under control, and forget about stopping it anytime soon. A heavy basalt bone of about 12 to 15 pounds will run 100 yards before taking its first breather. Expect another handful of spirited efforts before surrender. Cradle the carp under the belly and remove the fly. Revive. Repeat. It will take a few moments to catch your breath while you swab carp slime off your clothes with tepid river water. There are only a few hours of prime fishing. The winds inevitably whip down the canyon, chopping the flow and conspiring with the declining sun's glare to end your ability to see into the water. It's over. No sense in even attempting to spray casts hoping for a Hail Mary. It won't work. Back at the truck, after a cold can of beer, it's time to resurrect the river's ghosts, the salmon. No matter how good the day's carp fishing was, or wasn't, we'll abandon the carp post-game analysis in favor of commemorating the salmon. What it must have been like way back when, before the dams. how big the runs must have been, how good the fishing surely was, how we've been cheated, deprived, and robbed of our true fish. We'll silently nod our heads and spit into the dirt as we invoke yet another description of the phantoms to which we are shackled. Of course we'd rather be fishing the Nichuana for steelhead and salmon. Who wouldn't? The point is, we aren't. We can't. No one home. No forwarding address. Only these haunting spirits, unavoidable, ever-present, contemptible. We are witnesses to a never-ending eulogy. We are left only with the comfort of our indignation. We are left with Cyprinus Carpio. These are our ghosts, as much a measure of carping as the carp themselves. River Song, impossibly violent and savagely fast. My heart was pounding and my hands were shaking. He smelled like cucumbers. Cucumbers splashed with lemon. I had him under the belly and by the tail, pointing him toward the camera. He flashed teeth as drops of bloody salt water fell from his gills onto the fiberglass deck of the skiff. Barracuda, the big ones, leer as if they've done something depraved and wicked, and quite enjoyed the wickedness and depravity. This was an oversized Bahamian Flats predator, and her guide, Sizzle, wanted to take it home. He sprang down from the polling platform and grabbed the fish under the gills, holding it away from his body like an unexploded munition. He wrestled it to the deck, and in a few seconds, the business was done. I didn't watch what sounded like a 2x4 smacking a cinder block. It's easy to assign terrible motives to Barracuda. They are chaos agents, berserkers, marauders, the most maniacal things that roam the flats. They attack by ambush, and their judgments are fast and final. These traits are not their fault, but they eat a lot of bonefish, and according to Sizzle, they're delicious, slightly sweet with an undercurrent of ocean umami funk. The Barracuda destroyed an 8-inch chartreuse popper at 12:14 on a Tuesday afternoon. The flats were glassy. There was almost no wind. The weather was just getting sticky. The fish was in 3 feet of water, not moving, just finning, waiting. The take was impossibly violent and savagely fast. On the boat, we all yelped a little. The first run was short and punctuated by a 3-foot leap. The rage was terrifying. The second run was a torpedo pointed directly at the boat. It was a long shot, but what if the next jump landed the Barracuda in the skiff? 3.5 feet of slashing razor wire ripping at sunburned calves, a whirlwind of apex predator scalpels desperate for something to sever. We crouched instinctively and yelped again. By 12:36, the entire scene had played out. The Barracuda no longer smelled of cucumbers and lemons. The grin was still wicked, the drying skin pulling taut the flesh around his dagger teeth. His eyes had started to fade, but the dead stare made his gaze all the more creepy and unsettling, as if he were still capable of mayhem. We sat there in silence for a few moments, taking it all in, catching our breath, then got back to fishing. At the dock the following morning, a Sizzle slipped me a foil package. "It's your cuda," he said. The deep-fried chunk smelled like coconut oil and black pepper. Barracuda are not considered safe to eat. Due to their diet high in the food chain, they store a substance called ciguatoxin in their flesh. The larger the cuda, the more ciguatoxin, and there's no way to tell if a particular fish carries the poison or not. It's tasteless, doesn't smell, and cooking the fish doesn't kill it. If you consume a carrier, you have a chance of contracting ciguatera. There's no cure for ciguatera poisoning, which will bombard your gastrointestinal, neurological, and cardiovascular systems for anywhere from 2 days to a month, provoking symptoms that include vomiting, loose bowels, vertigo, heart problems, numbness, and even hallucinations. I thought about the leering Cuda, about how dangerous he looked, how evil I supposed him to be, his fury, his teeth, that malicious grin. I unwrapped the foil package and noticed my hands were shaking. I put a piece in my mouth. 2. Make the Sky Better, a meditation on the Western Cliff Swallow. True hope is swift and flies with swallow's wings. William Shakespeare. My friend Lang once hooked a cliff swallow during the annual bug blizzard that is the Mother's Day caddis hatch on the Yakima River in central Washington. As the bugs ascended from the bottom of the river, the swallows descended from their mud nests along the canyon's basalt walls. The trout noticed the bugs and began to slurp up the stragglers caught in the film. In an instant, a blustery, slow-moving spring afternoon on the water was transformed into a dramatic and frantic feeding session. Fluffy, billowing clouds of caddis, swooping birds, slashing trout, and hopeful anglers. We all met on the river's surface. The bugs were looking for love, the trout and the swallows were looking for a meal, and we were there to witness, and perhaps if everything went according to plan, fool one of those trout with a wisp of elk hair, the tip of a rooster feather, and a few inches of tinsel tied to a hook, a crafty, productive, and time-tested imitation. Suddenly, Lang yelled something that was not quite speech, a sort of choked-back holler that couldn't entirely escape his mouth. I turned from my casting to look as a tiny swallow cartwheeled wildly into the bank, still very much attached to the line. My heart sank, and I stood in the water dumbly. A swallow? Please no, anything but a swallow. On the river, anglers spend more time gazing upon swallows than any other creature. They are our constant, delightful companions. In the Yakima Canyon, and on any trout stream in the American West, deer, elk, moose, eagles, hawks, otters, dippers, mink, kingfishers, snakes, and field mice may take short curtain calls. But it's the swallow who's always on stage, always front and center, always entertaining. Fish may be rising to gulp bugs. Other lesser birds may be squawking and crying. Clouds will come together and pull apart in entrancing combinations. But it's the swallows that mesmerize. It's the swallows that never fail to lift our hearts. On the river and off, we've shamelessly convinced ourselves that we share the best qualities with these birds. Swallows alight in us thoughts of freedom, of course, but also inspire the notion of a brilliant non-attachment, a carefree, in-the-moment appreciation for the now that might make a Buddhist monk smile from atop his meditation cushion. For such small animals, a chubby swallow only just approaches an ounce, they inspire grand thoughts and warm feelings. Their unbridled display of pure joy and their open-hearted loyalty to a piece of water and its seasons inspires the same feelings in us. Just the sight of them signifies a homecoming, a returning year after year, a sense of kinship to our friends and the earth. We don't have to be told that in art, religion, and myth, swallows have symbolized these things for centuries. We know it instinctively, just by gazing upon them. Swallows are on the river for the bugs, and, we'd like to imagine, for the sheer ecstatic delight of simply being under the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?